I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. The U.S. government is investing billions of dollars to develop a vaccine to prevent the spread of COVID-19, and companies are working at warp speed to bring a vaccine to market. President Trump is promising a vaccine by Election Day and criticized the FDA recently for requiring that outside experts sign off on the safety and efficacy of a vaccine before the agency gives its approval. Trump said it sounded like a political move. A vaccine is really our only hope to get the pandemic under control, since testing is spotty and there are not uniform rules and guidelines about masks and distancing. But the public is losing confidence in a vaccine. The Pew Research Center reported that in September, just half of the public said it would get vaccinated, a 21% drop since May. We asked Carl Zimmer to join us to explain where we are when it comes to clinical trials, what vaccines show promise, what's a realistic time frame. He's a science writer and columnist for the New York Times, author of a number of books, including Planet of Viruses and She Has Her Mother's Laugh. Carl Zimmer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And I should say he is joining us by Skype. Let me just make sure our listeners can join us as well. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and call us at 1-888-477-9499. Carl, how many companies are working on a vaccine for coronavirus? And we're talking about companies around the world.
A lot.
You know, okay.
I have been trying to keep track of all of them, sort of the reaching out and trying to confirm who is actively working on things. So far, we're counting 42 active clinical trials on vaccines. Mm-hmm. In other words, these are trials that are in which people have volunteered to have the vaccine put in them. But on top of that, there are perhaps at least 93 preclinical projects underway. So between them, there have to be at least 130 projects. There might be more, but you know, we're still trying to track everything down.
Wow. So, I mean, it's interesting that even you do not know the answer to that. But looking at some of these clinical trials, how close are companies, or is a company, to bringing a vaccine to market?
So the way that vaccines get tested in people in clinical trials, they go through three what are known as phases. And the third phase is the large phase in which people are compared who get a placebo to the vaccine, and they look for side effects and they look to see if it's actually protective. So the phase three trial data is what really matters when a vaccine is going to be considered for approval. And there are 10 vaccines worldwide that are in phase three, five of them in the United States.
Are there concerns, or even are you concerned, that because this is really being fast-tracked, that the normal process of getting a vaccine to market is it can take years, sometimes even decades? We're talking months. Are there concerns about corners being cut?
Well, there's no evidence that corners have been cut in the actual trials. There are concerns about how quickly people will take that phase three trial data once it comes out and say, okay, let's go with this. Right. You know, a number of vaccine experts and trial experts are telling some of the leading companies like Pfizer, like, you need to wait. You need to wait until you have more data. And, you know, if that means November, December, so be it. On the other hand, you know, the reason that vaccines have taken so long in the past, you know, a decade, 15 years,
sure.
It's because part of it is just because it's a really risky thing to do financially. It's expensive to run clinical trials. It's even more expensive to set up a factory to make vaccines because they have very special requirements. And so basically, the way vaccines used to work was that you would take one step, you say, this looks promising in mice. Okay, now let's set up a clinical trial. Okay, let's do a small clinical trial and see how that works out. Look at all the data, then set up the next one. And so there's sort of built in all of this pausing and waiting and pausing and waiting. And so what's happening now is that, you know, governments like the United States government, philanthropical organizations are coming in and saying, like, okay, look, go build that factory. We will de-risk that for you. because we want, if the trials show that this vaccine works, we want to be making it right away. We don't want to wait for you to build a factory after we show that it works.
And when you say build a factory, you mean build a factory, right?
I mean build a factory, sure, yeah. Right. Or convert an existing factory to from making another vaccine to this one. Vaccines it's very challenging to make vaccines. They have to meet very high standards for purity. All sorts of things have to be tracked in terms of temperatures and chemicals and so on. And you know, you're packing this vaccine into millions and millions of little vials. It's not something you start doing overnight.
Well, kudos to people who are willing to be part of these trials. I think they probably don't get enough credit for the kind of work that they're doing. But I know, Carl, that one of these studies got stopped because there was a problem. What do we know? Have they figured out what the problem was?
So what's built into the vaccine testing process is a constant monitoring for anything that might indicate that a vaccine has harmful side effects. And the reason being that you're going to give vaccines to lots of people, lots of healthy people, to prevent them from getting sick. And so vaccines have an incredibly high bar in terms of safety. And so even if one person out of tens of thousands of people starts to show some symptoms that are concerning, the whole thing can stop while the advisory board takes a look and decides, well, okay, is it possible this was caused by the vaccine, or does this seem to be coincidental? So in the case of one of these trials from a company called AstraZeneca, in September 6th, they stopped their trial because one person in their English trial was suffering from symptoms that the New York Times reported was called transverse myelitis, which is basically inflammation of the spinal cord. Oh. And it's the kind of condition that usually just resolves itself. But, you know, this patient apparently it resolved itself in a few days. But they were like, OK, we need to make sure that this is not something that was caused by the vaccine. Now, the British regulators took a look at what was going on, and they decided that the vaccine was not responsible. And then they allowed it to go forward. There was another trial of this. It's the same vaccine in the United States. It has not started to go forward yet, so it is still on pause.
I just got the seasonal flu vaccine, and we know the coronavirus has these unique features. When companies are developing these vaccines, are they doing with this virus what they have done with other viruses, which is obviously trying to safely figure out how to inject that into a human being?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, this is actually kind of ordinary vaccine research. This virus, aside from being unbelievably contagious and causing huge amounts of death, it actually is it's not a particularly exceptional virus in the sense that, you know, it sticks lots of big proteins off of its surface, which are pretty easy for our immune system to recognize. And so the idea behind all these vaccines that people are testing is like, how do we get our immune systems to recognize this virus, you know, by those proteins or maybe by dead viruses that we put into people's bodies safely so that they can mount a really strong response. It's just what has been done for lots and lots of vaccines in the past against things like measles and mumps and chickenpox and so on. This is just in the future, once we get past this horrific pandemic, I mean, this might just be one of those vaccines that, you know, everybody gets just as a matter of course, like you got your flu shot. That's what it'll be.
Here's a comment from Paul. He says, some vaccines, Moderna, Pfizer, need to be stored at sub-zero temperatures. Is this practical for 300 million doses? And Carl, I was reading about that, but also that there are some vaccines that look like they can just be put in refrigerators. How significant is this feature?
It could be very significant. The irony is that the vaccines that have moved fastest through these clinical trials are ones that are based on genetic material. And this genetic material, it's actually pretty easy to create the vaccines in the first place and to produce lots of copies, because all you need to do is just make lots of genes. So they're easy to test. they're relatively easy to make, but yeah, they have to be kept super cold because otherwise the little oily bubbles that hold the genetic material just fall apart. Whereas there are others that can be refrigerated. Some might even be able to just be kept on the shelf. But those actually take longer to design, longer to test. It takes a while to get them going. So those kinds of vaccines might go into clinical trials, you know, more like starting this fall and then into the spring.
Interesting. I mean, obviously some trade-offs there. I mean, President Trump has talked about a vaccine by Election Day. What do you think is a reasonable date for when a coronavirus vaccine will be available to the public?
Well, I think it's important that people understand like what it takes to get a vaccine to the public. And so there will be a series of steps here. There are phase three trials going on now. Now, at some point, the people who are making those vaccines are going to be, as they're looking at people getting sick with COVID in, among their volunteers, there will come a point in which they may say, okay, we need to take a look at the data and see how many of our subjects actually got vaccinated. And if there are like very few people who got vaccinated got sick and all the rest were the people who got the placebo, that could be enough to say, I think we have something here. Now they may need to wait longer to keep an eye on people, whether they get sick or not. Then they give that data to the FDA. Then the FDA has an external board that's going to take a look at that. And so there are these, and then they're going to have to make a decision. What kind of approval do we give? In some cases, vaccines get a license. In this case, they might get something called emergency approval. But then you got to be making the stuff, and then you got to distribute it. You got to get it to lots of places, and then you have to set up for the people to receive it. And really, like, we haven't done anything like this on this scale, period. So basically, for the president to claim, oh, this will all happen by Election Day, yeah. I don't see other basis for him saying that at all.
Well, and obviously this is a global pandemic. So even if we're able to, let's say, vaccinate 300 million Americans, you've got the rest of the world that we have to figure out how to help them.
Absolutely. And it would be incredibly short-sighted to think that if you just start vaccinating just some people in one country that somehow you've taken care of the pandemic. You haven't. And even for the people who are getting the vaccine, if the rest of the world isn't getting vaccinated, that then represents a risk for that country that's been vaccinated. So we do need a global strategy. We don't really have one, unfortunately.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Carl Zimmer. He's a science writer, also a columnist for the New York Times. We are talking about where we are when it comes to a vaccine for COVID-19. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we'll be talking about some vaccine reluctance that we're hearing about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Carl Zimmer about where things stand when it comes to a vaccine for the COVID-19 virus. And again, you can join us, radiotimes@whyy.org. Carl, I had mentioned that the Pew Research Center study showing that there was decreased supporter or confidence, I guess, in a coronavirus vaccine. It was an interesting poll today from Axios Ipsos asking Americans, well, if your doctor told you it was safe, would you get a vaccine versus if President Trump said it was safe? If your doctor said it was safe, then 62% of people said, yeah, I probably would get a vaccine. If it were President Trump who said it was safe, it was down to 19%. So it matters who's telling us whether a vaccine is safe or not. Can you speak to that?
Well, I'm clearly the president is not inspiring confidence as a vaccine expert, I guess. No. which is too bad because, you know, he has incredible vaccine experts working throughout the government that he could consult with. But he doesn't seem to be when he makes these big claims about vaccines being ready by election day, which makes people feel that something must be rushed. As I said, there's no evidence that safety is being compromised in the trials as they're being run. And it's really important in order for these vaccines to have their maximum benefit that people do feel confident in them and take them in large numbers because, you know, the first initial vaccines, you know, it's possible that they're not 100% effective. The FDA has actually drawn a line of 50% efficacy. Now, you know, I'd much prefer a 100% effective vaccine to a 50% one, but still that improves your odds. And not only that, but overall, if enough people get them, it really makes it hard for that virus to get around. And so you will expect overall rates of infection to drop, even for people who haven't gotten the vaccine. So, you know, and so that's why we need people to feel confident to get the vaccine and get the vaccine and get it quickly. If we want to get back to life as normal, vaccines are an essential part of the plan.
Tommy has a comment about herd immunity, which has gotten a lot of attention. And I've read a number of different things about it, that if you had, let's say, 50, 60, maybe 70% of the population was vaccinated, that would give you some form of herd immunity. Lancet came out recently and said that just 10% of the American population, I guess, would be part of that category so far. So what do we need to know about herd immunity and how to get to it?
We want to get to herd immunity through vaccination. The alternative is millions of Americans dying. That's it.
There's nothing
more to say. That's the choice. And anyone who says, oh, we're going to get to herd immunity any day now, is setting us up for catastrophic death. There's no other way of putting it.
And yet, we've got, frankly, members of the Trump administration advising the president about doing just that, which is allowing this virus to wreak its havoc. And frankly, people are going to pay the price.
They are. And, you know, these advisors, you know, one is a neuroradiologist who seems to be ignoring the expert advice from epidemiologists and immunologists. I don't know why. But the fact remains, my colleague Donald McNeil in today's New York Times has a long piece on how it is that only around 10% of Americans have had COVID so far. And if you're saying like, oh, we just need to get up to 60 or 70%, well, look how many people have died already. 204,000 Americans. Do the math. What's going to happen? You're going to get over a million people dying. I mean, and we don't want that. If we can just use tried and true measures, things like social distancing, things like masks and so on, we can and wait for the vaccines to be proven safe and then have them well distributed, we can save hundreds of thousands of lives from this herd immunity fantasy.
I mean, it's so incredible to me. We're, you know, 9 months into the start of the pandemic, about 6 months into when we realized what it was that we were dealing with, and still these very basic measure to protect yourself and to protect others still doesn't seem to resonate with the public. And frankly, you know, we don't hear that coming with a unified voice from the U.S. government and frankly from the White House.
There are a lot of aspects of this. You know, we could talk for a whole hour about this. I mean, I think one thing I would say is that, you know, the United States, you know, we Americans are just not used to this kind of thing. If you look at countries like South Korea or Hong Kong, you know, they dealt with other coronaviruses. They dealt with SARS in 2003. They dealt with MERS, an outbreak in South Korea in, I believe it was 2015, just a few years ago. And they could see for themselves just how devastating these kinds of coronaviruses could get. And they prepared. They accepted masks. They accepted contact tracing and so on. And so for us, some people feel like it's an intrusion and so on, and it feels uncomfortable. But, you know, Masks are uncomfortable. Yeah. Ventilators are really uncomfortable.
Yeah, and that's what happens when you're really in a crisis in a hospital. Here's a question from Christine. Almost all the vaccines so far required 2 injections, and she wants to know why. Carl?
Well, when you're dealing with a new virus, in a lot of cases, what you're going to need is you're going to need one virus to kind of set things up, and then you're going to need a second virus, you know, maybe a few weeks later, to really kind of drive a boost home and give you long-lasting protection. It's just sort of the nature of the way that the immune system works. Now, may not necessarily have to be that way. Again, we're dealing with a new virus, and you know, these vaccine researchers are just, you know, they're running the trials to figure out exactly what they need. And some think, from earlier evidence, you're going to need 2 doses. But Johnson & Johnson is rolling out a big 60,000 person phase 3 trial where they're only using 1 dose. They think that might work, and there are some others that might only need 1 dose too. I mean, that would be a real boon if sure. you could just use 1 dose, because imagine, you know, trying to get hundreds of millions of people to come back for the second dose. That's going to be a challenge.
We're going to be talking about kids and COVID and schools, but where do things stand with a COVID vaccine for children? You did a story recently. What's the time frame on that, and what are the unique challenges for developing a vaccine for children?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's an unfortunate assumption when people are looking at the New York Times vaccine tracker or reading about vaccine news. They just assume, like, well, okay, as soon as a vaccine gets an emergency use approval, then everybody, including kids, can start getting it. And actually, that's not the case. That there will actually have to be some tests specifically on children. Very careful tests to make sure that it is safe and effective specifically for that group. And so that is going to add time to how long it takes to get the vaccines to kids. And sadly, in the United States, there are no trials of coronavirus vaccines on children that have started yet. And so that's going to take months, maybe a year, to go through that whole process. You don't want to skimp on it, because you don't want to give kids dangerous vaccines. It's going to take a while. Yeah. So I hate to bring that kind of disappointing news to parents, but that's just how it is.
Well, I appreciate Carl Zimmer. I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, getting us up to speed on such an important issue. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's a science writer and columnist for the New York Times, author of a number of books, including Planet of Viruses and She Has Her Mother's Laugh. Well, as we were just saying, while most parents and school personnel agree that in-person education is best for K through 12 students, there's still little agreement about whether it's safe for children, their teachers, and staff to be together when the coronavirus is still such a public health threat. Now, some kids are back in the classroom, some are learning remotely, and some are doing both as school districts struggle to decide the best choice for everyone. One of the problems is there is so little data about infection and transmission rates involving schools. Our guest, economist Emily Oster, built a platform, the COVID-19 School Response Dashboard, and is tracking coronavirus cases so far in 700 schools in 48 states, including 400,000 students and 47,000 staff. And she has some data to share with us. She's a professor of economics at Brown University, author of 2 books, Expecting Better and Crib Sheet, also co-founder of the website COVID Explained. And Emily Oster, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you with us. And to our listeners, you can always join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. So much to talk about, but let's begin with your dashboard. What kind of information are you inputting into your dashboard to figure out what's happening in schools?
Yeah, so the dashboard really starts by coming to the schools and asking them some things about how they're opening. Are they remote? Are they hybrid? How many kids do they have in the classroom? What kind of mitigation strategies are they taking? Are they masking? Are they distancing? We really wanted to start by understanding the context. And then we come back and we ask them, okay, how many COVID cases did you have over, you know, this 2-week period, that 2-week period? So really, when you look at the dashboard, you can see sort of the top line thing, which is, I think, what people come for, which is to look at the infection rates, and then also some information about learning models and so on.
Well, as you say on this website, and you had a piece in the New York Times today, there are 56 million school children in this country. You're looking at 400,000. Nonetheless, what did you find in terms of infection or even transmission rates?
Yeah, so in the for the confirmed infection rates in students, the rate is about 0.069% over the sort of first 2 week period. So that says over that 2 weeks, in the average school of like 1,450 kids, you'd expect one case. Mm-hmm. And for staff, it's 0.14%. So it's a little harder to think about that, but in a staff of 100 people, you'd expect about 0.14 cases, or so.
Right. I'm losing my math sense. go from numbers to words. What does that mean?
I mean, I think that cases are relatively rare. Confirmed cases are relatively rare in schools. So if your kid's school has if your kid's school has 1,000 kids, every 2 weeks you'd expect about one kid to have COVID.
So one out of 1,000. Let me ask you, because this just came out of the CDC, and their determination was that 1 in 10 people with infections in this country is a child. And they looked at 49 states, and they looked at hospitalization rates and things like that. But they found, that would be a 10% rate of infection in the United States that involves children. Can you speak to that?
Sure. I mean, I think you want to think about, I don't know exactly how they're defining children, but it's typically people under 20. And so that's a pretty large share of the population, much more than 10%. So if you thought 10% of the cases were in that group, it would mean that that's a group that's much less likely to be infected than the rest of the population.
The difficulty is for parents and frankly for all of us is just trying to figure out what these numbers are. And one of the things you said in today's piece in the Times is we need to look at the denominator. I actually Googled that just to make sure I remembered what that was from my school days. It's the number below the line in a fraction. But why is that important?
So, I mean, I think the reason this is important, particularly for something like schools, is, we hear a lot of numbers that I think people find pretty scary. Like, there were 5 cases in a school, or this school has a case, this school has 2 cases. And I think, that we really want to think about the number of kids that are in school. And that's what I mean by the denominator. So if you say, we had 5 cases and that's in a school of 4,000 people, that's very different than if you said we have 5 cases and that's in a school of 50 people. Because, of course, like the chance that you interact with somebody who's sick is much smaller if the school mm-hmm. is much bigger with the same number of cases. But just in general, when you think about the risk to your kid, what's the chance that they get it? You really need to understand the base rate, not just the case counts. And I think that's really what we're kind of focused on.
And looking at your dashboard, can you tell whether even if it's a small transmission rate, is it happening in schools? Is it happening outside of schools? Because obviously students and their teachers and staff spend time together, but they also spend a lot of time outside of the classroom or outside of the schoolyard.
We can't see that in the dashboard yet. So what we can see in the dashboard is basically reported cases. And so my guess is that a lot of those cases have come in from outside. And so you'd want to do things like compare the rates in the dashboard to the rates that you're seeing, like in the overall community. These rates in the dashboard are much lower in most cases than the rates in the overall communities, which suggests certainly that schools are not high infection areas.
Let me get a call. Yeah, I'm sorry. Did you want to add something to that?
No.
Okay, cool. Let me get Jane, who's calling us from Bucks County. And Jane, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Wonderful guest. Thanks so much.
You're
so
welcome.
It's worth noting there are 11 states that specifically don't track COVID cases in school. Right now, Pennsylvania is among them. A little strange because we do track cases in other congregate settings like skilled nursing and prisons, but we exclude schools. So specific to this listening audience, there is a website who takes publicly available data and translates it by school district. That's Mainline Mama, and I can't speak to who that individual is, But mm-hmm. many of us who are educators rely on that data to get a window into our school district. Larger, when you pull back and look at numbers larger than your own district, it starts to lose meaning because these things, you know, travel so specifically within a community. And I'm wondering if your guest is aware of this individual's work and has any comment on its veracity.
Well, I think you raise a really important point, Jane, and something, Emily, that you look about it and have actually complained about, which is we don't have a uniform system of reporting cases. So we're working in many ways in the dark. Can you speak to what Jane just said?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would sort of amplify that I think the fact that, you know, there is no kind of official reporting system in many places is very problematic. It's part of the reason we started this site, and also part of the reason it sort of felt like I don't really know why we had to do it. I will say on our site you can filter by state, so mm-hmm. we can look at places in Pennsylvania. We do have a number of schools reporting from Pennsylvania. I think some of them are probably independent schools. So, you know, again, sort of what I think would be ideal is if we had really good official data from states, and I hope that will continue to grow, and we could even be a platform for some of that. But in the sort of interim, kind of starting at schools or starting at districts is going to give us a window into that, even without the official kind of reporting structure.
We're almost up on a break here, but it seems to me, I mean, community and context counts, as we know. So, I mean, some communities have very high levels of coronavirus and some very low.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about the school opens is that actually a number of the places where schools are open in person are places with very high rates. And so on the one hand, you'd say, boy, I'm surprised to hear that. On the other hand, you know, that is an opportunity to learn about kind of the risks that we're likely to face. And it's almost, you might see it as kind of an upper bound on what you'd expect to happen in places which have lower transmission or lower rates.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with economist Emily Oster, and she is a professor of economics at Brown University. We're talking about the COVID-19 school response dashboard. She's co-founder of the website COVID Explained, and she's written a couple of books, Expecting Better and Crib Sheet. And we are talking about how to look at risk and understand risk when it comes to sending children to school. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us, as our caller just did. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. There has been a lot of debate about whether kids can safely return to school. Some have, some haven't. Some are doing kind of a hybrid, partial in-class and partial remote learning. We're talking with Emily Oster. She's a Brown University economist, and she's been tracking COVID cases in a number of schools to find out what's going on, to just share what she has found. And again, she is a professor of economics at Brown University and co-founder of the website COVID Explained. Emily, do you have kids? Are you sending them to school? What did you decide personally?
I do, yeah. I have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they are in full-time in-person school at the moment. So
and,
I think, yeah.
No, I was going to say, how did you think through that, and how did you decide that this was the best choice for your children?
You know, I think that there were sort of two factors for us. One was really thinking about what the precautions the school was taking. So our kids are, you know, masked. Everyone's masked all the time, including the 5-year-olds. The school thought a lot about how to distance and how to do symptom tracking and sort of the kinds of things that we think are important for prevention. And at the same time, I think, you know, we kind of recognize the real benefits to our kids from being in school. You know, we saw some of the downsides of having them home all spring, and I think they really need to be in school.
Well, and I think most people feel that way, but just don't feel confident enough that they can make that decision for their children. I know in Philadelphia, the public school system is being done remotely, and we know the kind of stresses that puts on families, especially families of low income who are trying to juggle work and maybe don't even have the kind of technology that they know that their kids can be plugged into their schools. What do we do about that?
I think it's really challenging. I mean, there was a New Yorker had a piece this morning that's really heartbreaking about the kind of like issues around remote learning. And I think, you know, in some sense, the answer to what we do about that is we need to figure out how to bring kids back to school safely. Yeah. And a big piece of that is recognizing, you know, is thinking about how large are the risks really. And I think that, you know, the data is starting to sort of come out and show that those risks are fairly small if you open schools in ways that are safe. And so that means really, I think, thinking through, and this is part of what we're hoping to contribute here, you know, thinking through, okay, sure, what's it going to take? Is it masks? Is it, you know, is it sort of some distance between the seats? Like, how can we do this in a way that makes people feel confident and not scared, but also lets their kids benefit from the having in-person schooling and not being, you know, we don't want the situation in which 10-year-olds are being left alone in their house to Zoom school all day while their parents are at work. That's not, you know, that's not good.
It's also the challenge in trying to figure out who is safe and what are effective safety measures is that when we talk about children, we talk about what people under the age of 21 or 18 and how an 18-year-old behaves and how a 5-year-old behaves is totally different. You're not going to find 5-year-olds hanging at bars, for instance.
Right. Hopefully you don't find 18-year-olds either, but that may be wishful thinking. I mean, I think that you bring up a really good point, which is, you know, that the risks seem to be somewhat different by age. So actually the youngest kids seem to be at the smallest risk of COVID. They seem to be the least likely to transmit it. They are also the ones that are likely to benefit the most from in-person school. So I think as we think about, you know, methods for reopening, and a lot of districts have moved in this direction, you know, thinking about let's bring back the youngest kids first. That's the group that's the most vulnerable, the most likely to be losing learning, and the least likely to you know, get other people sick or get sick themselves. Let's try with them, see how that goes. And then, you know, we can add in older grades later. And I think, you know, there's some real evidence suggesting that that might be a good approach. Certainly in our data, we're seeing, you know, lower rates in elementary schools than in high schools. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, risk is an interesting thing to talk about, especially with an economist, because I think for the rest of us, risk feels very personal. I mean, if it's your kid, you know, you don't want to do something to put them at risk. But we do that all day long when we get into a car and drive somewhere. We are taking a risk. Can you help us understand how you view and value risk?
Yeah, I mean, I think you put it exactly right, which is I think it's that we take a lot of risks every day, risks with ourselves, risks with our kids that we don't really think about. So every year you send your kid to school, people send their kids to school during flu season, and they're taking the risk that their kids will get the flu. And kids can be very sick from the flu. It can be very bad. They're actually much more vulnerable than adults, which is not true of COVID. We put our kids in the car. We do other, you know, things that are risky in that space. And so I think we don't think about them. So the COVID risk is very salient. People are thinking about it all the time. It's always on our mind. But it isn't necessarily different, particularly for kids. It isn't necessarily different or more than the other risks you're always taking that you kind of implicitly are willing to take. And so I think sometimes, you know, there's a temptation to kind of get to the point of saying, well, if there was any risk, if there was any chance my kid would get COVID, I would never send them to school. And I think that's not really consistent with a lot of the other choices that you're probably making in other aspects of your life.
I mean, it's so interesting to think about it. And I've heard public health people and epidemiologists and experts in COVID-19 who are not affiliated with the government in any way saying that they don't believe it is safe to send children to school. So risk can look very different depending on if you're an economist or if you're a parent or if you're a public health person or perhaps even if you're an administrator of a school district.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of considerations. And I think part of what's made this really difficult to evaluate is we haven't had the kind of evidence we need to think about the size of those risks. So even from the standpoint of an epidemiologist, I think, you know, there's part of what's hard is just if the answer is, I don't really know, when I send kids back to school, is it going to be, you know, 1 in 1,000 kids who get a kind of mild illness, or is mm-hmm. it going to be 300 in 1,000? And our data looks more like 1 in 1,000. And again, you know, this is not serious illness. This is, you know, people who have kind of generally pretty mild cases. And that number is, you know, that number is fairly small.
How do you factor in the fact that we're learning that the White House has been putting pressure on the CDC to open schools? And frankly, according to the New York Times, wanting the CDC to produce more reports and charts showing a decline in coronavirus cases among young people. How do we factor in the kind of pressure coming from the administration to open the schools?
Yeah, I mean, I find this whole this is a very unfortunate situation. You know, I think part of you know, there are reasons to open schools or you know, maybe the reasons to not open schools, but they should be based in science and not politics. And one of the things that has happened as a result of this sort of particular politicization of this discussion is that we've seen schools open in places that are the highest risk and not open in places that are the lowest risk. So we're seeing schools open in places like Florida and Georgia, which have, you know, fairly high case counts of COVID, and not opening in places like Massachusetts, which with very low cases. And somehow it feels like, you know, it's not just that politics is kind of influencing the decision. It's completely driving the decision to open, which seems like exactly the opposite of what you would hope would be happening.
But your message is when there are a lot of cases, that's a reason not to open schools, not the reverse.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think in places where, you know, in places with very high, you know, positivity rates, there are better reasons not to open schools. Mm-hmm. Although in practice, what we're seeing is those are the places that are opening schools. And those school reopenings are probably going better than people had expected, although, you know, still that might be ill-advised.
Sure. Here's a comment from Rick. He says there's a school in Warminster, which is outside of Philadelphia, with 461 children, where they are all go to school, no virtual learning. Teachers rotate in from room to room, not the children, and it's going very well. He sees this as a success story. Kathy in Chester County says economists interpret data differently from scientists or epidemiologists. There's just not enough data yet based on 2 weeks of school. Self-reported data can also be questionable. Can you speak to that, Emily?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, you know, we have a couple of weeks of data, although I will say when you sort of look more broadly, there are a bunch of districts that have been open for 5 or 6 weeks at this point. So I think in the kind of broad sense, we have a little bit of more evidence. And it's absolutely right that the data is, you know, that this data in general is self-reported. And I think that, you know, this is something that we all really need to keep pushing on getting better evidence on this, and, you know, really looking at the whole picture and saying, okay, you know, we opened schools in Georgia. What have we seen happen to case counts in Georgia in general? That's something that I think it would be you know, interesting to look at, and I'm hoping that people will look at.
Are there things we can learn from Europe, for instance, or even from South Korea or New Zealand? I'm thinking of countries that have done a good job of trying to contain this virus.
Yeah, I mean, I think, in general, when we look at schools in Europe, the data is very reassuring. You know, the UK open schools is probably the closest to us in terms of case rates, and that was a very successful reopen. They had very, very limited cases. So it's not that we've seen none, but they've been limited. I think one of the issues that people have raised is that, you know, Europe tends to have the virus more under control than the U.S. And so there's some concern that maybe that that somehow it's hard to learn from the European experience, which I think is fair.
I mean, it's just, yeah, very different experience. Here's a comment from Sherry, who says Bucks County's Department of Health director recommends, quote, modified quarantine for all schools in Bucks County. According to this guidance, students and staff exposed to a positive case in school would not have to quarantine at home for any length of time. Since they are masked most of the time, these exposed individuals could return to school as normal and simply monitor for symptoms. What do you think about that, Emily Oster?
I mean, I think this is a tricky thing, and there are costs in both directions. So I was talking to somebody the other day who's running a school district in Ohio, and they've had 10,000 kids in school for 5 weeks. They've had 8 cases, but they've had to quarantine about 400 children because they were in, you know, some proximity to someone who was a case. And, you know, none of those people showed up with symptoms. And so this person, you know, was the superintendent, was expressing a lot of frustration that it's really taking a mental health toll on their kids. When, you know, the reality is that at least for them, the kind of actual realized infections as a result of that was very low. And so it was zero. And so I think that, you know, there are risks either way. You certainly don't want to be, you don't want to be overly aggressive with that. But I think there are also costs to being overly cautious.
And there is the problem of asymptomatic carriers. And apparently children are pretty good at that.
Children do tend to be asymptomatic. We also know that they also tend to be, and this is based on data from South Korea, they also tend to be much less likely to transmit, even conditional on infection. So the fact that they are asymptomatic does also seem to lower the transmission, at least in some data.
How do you see the press coverage of coronavirus? And do you think there's too much hysterical coverage of the pandemic?
I mean, I think that the pandemic is very scary, and the press coverage is, you know, reflecting people's fears, and that's, you know, I think that's pretty understandable. You know, there are certainly things that I read where I think, boy, probably that could have been written in a slightly less scary way. But, you know, at the same time, I do understand that the press partly has a responsibility to kind of help people understand some of the risks, and there are places where people are not taking the pandemic as seriously as they should.
I mean, do you think there should be more coverage of, I can't even use the word success because we're not through this thing yet, but more coverage of some of the work that you're doing or some of the things that you're finding?
I mean,
of course you do, Emily Osser.
Yes,
I know.
Absolutely. Everybody should be covering me all
of
the
course.
Time.
No, I mean, yes, exactly.
That's the main thing they should do. No, I mean, look, I think that there is in some ways it's not that interesting to, you know, we have this dashboard, you know, like to every day be like, okay, there are some more schools in this dashboard. Oh, they still don't have as much COVID. That is not that. That's maybe not as exciting or sensational. And so I think that that is something that comes up when we think about coverage, is just, you know, trying to recognize that there's maybe more interest in kind of surprising, exciting news, and that's just the way it is.
I mean, if we could roll back the clock and try to figure out how to do this better, this meaning this pandemic better, how would you have liked to see schools then? And this is broadly speaking, of course, schools then deal with the pandemic once we realized in the spring what was happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there wasn't much to do in the spring. I think it was too scary. I would have liked the schools to, it would have been great if at the start of the summer there had been more of a concerted effort to prioritize the need for schools to open in the fall. And that would mean, you know, both kind of having a better plan, probably collecting more quickly the kinds of data over the summer that would be useful, you know, from childcare centers or camps, to try to get a more systematic sense of, you know, whether these are high risk activities. Also, you know, planning. I think one of the things that's happened in a lot of districts is they're kind of like they've gotten to the point of opening, and then there are many things missing from the plan, and you know, there's not enough PPE or there's not enough distance. And I think there were opportunities to do that early on, which were not undertaken. I mean, even an opportunity to set up a data collection system.
Sure. Well, by design, we have a decentralized, fragmented school system by design.
Yeah, by design. Yes, but it's not great for COVID data. That's for sure.
So looking ahead, I mean, should there be some kind of system to either require schools or put more pressure on schools to share their data so that parents and teachers and staff and administrators and students can know better what's going on in their particular district or their particular school?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I am in favor of transparency. And so I think that, you know, it would be great if there was a more systematic way to do this. I think we also want to be careful not to sort of malign or blame school districts. And I think a lot of districts and schools are afraid of this kind of data entry, which is partly why our dashboard is completely anonymized. So you cannot see what school district it is, because we wanted districts to be willing to participate and give us their information, because we think that there's sort of value in this approach. But people are very afraid that somehow, you know, people are going to come back and say, oh, you're the COVID school, or you did something wrong, when really what's happening is maybe cases are coming from the outside.
Well, Emily Oster, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she's a professor of economics at Brown University, co-founder of the website COVID Explained, and we were talking about the COVID-19 school response dashboard. She's also the author of several books, including Expecting Better and Crib Sheet. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, which you can do wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Stop. Before you consider taking drastic measures to lose weight, like GLP-1 injections, consider Golo. Golo's release is easier than injections and fad diets. No need to jump through insurance hoops. It's simple. You take one release supplement with each meal. Golo's release supplement contains 7 natural plants and 3 key minerals that target body fat and combat the stress of dieting. With Golo, you follow the Golo for Life plan, where you'll safely and effectively control sugar cravings and hunger while minimizing muscle loss, allowing you to feel good and inspired to reach your goal weight. With Golo, you get an effective and affordable weight loss solution that's clinically proven. Because controlling glucose, maintaining healthy insulin levels, and saying goodbye to starvation dieting is the secret to lasting weight loss and wellness. Visit Golo.com to get started today. That's Golo.com. Go to Golo.com to join the 5 million people who have switched to Golo as a better way to lose weight. Visit Golo.com today.